The Business on RTÉ Radio 1 with AIB. We know that your focus is on your business. That's why ours is on supporting you.
But first this morning, we're joined by a man from the worlds of aviation and space technology, but who also has big plans closer to home in Ireland. Donal Slattery founded two of the top three aircraft leasing companies in the world over the last 25 years. He set up Avalon in 2010. 4 years later, he listed it on the New York Stock Exchange, the largest ever listing by an Irish-founded company at that time. And we'll go back to the space technology stuff, Donal, because you're joining me here now in studio. And I also want to talk to you about this new initiative you have for innovation in Ireland. But let's go back to the start first. You're originally from Ennis in Clare, grew up in the town.
Grew up in the market in Ennis. My father was a greengrocer, Jack Slattery, and he was born and bred in the town of Ennis. And so I was a townie, as we say, down that part of the world.
And because he had a shop, you were living above the shop when you were a kid.
That's right. Yeah. So I was born in 1967 and lived above the shop for 7 or 8 years before we moved outside the town. But yeah, I grew up in the market in Ennis, and Ennis is, and certainly back then was a very vibrant market town. And so every Saturday, you know, everybody came in to the market to sell their wares, the farmers, and it was just a wondrous place to grow up as a child.
It was a bit of a playground then, really.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I mean, my father, you know, as a greengrocer, working behind the counter, stacking the shelves, I still remember. My favourite time of the week was when the Tato van arrived. And back then, Tato had their own vans, and the Tato man, it was a big, he even looked like Mr. Tato. And my job was to stack the bags of Tatos and, of course, you know, put one in the back pocket. 2p, there were 2p a bag then.
It was a small crime, 2p crime.
I still like cheese and onion. And, you know, my brother, I have one brother, and he's a salt and vinegar merchant, and I'm very much cheese and onion.
And that's for life. That never changes.
No, that's inbred.
And did you learn a bit about business and about watching your dad? Did you learn from him?
Well, you know, I suppose you don't realise it at the time that you do, but I think there's a few takeaways from then. My dad was wonderful with customers. And no matter how cranky they were or whatever they were giving out about, he was able to sort of calm them down. And he had the ability to connect with people. And I think I watched and learned the skills of that, because I think it is an acquired skill. Some people innately have it, but I think you can learn to do that. And counting the pennies, literally. I was not bad at maths at the time, and I just was kind of good at totting up the numbers. And obviously there was no calculators or phones or anything like that. And you know, he worked every hour of every day. And I suppose the work ethic piece that travels with that.
And you would have had a connection, an early connection with the world of flying and aviation, because you were quite close to Shannon. And your dad used to go there.
Yeah, so he was a greengrocer, but he also sold wholesale fruit and vegetables. And his biggest customer was Shannon Airport. And he would deliver fresh fruit and vegetables to the flight kitchen. And we're in the 60s and the 70s, where at that time Shannon was certainly one of the busiest airports in the world, because the aircraft going east-west across the Atlantic had to stop to refuel. So literally, you know, 10 miles down the road from Ennis, and you were in this wonderland. And that there's no question that that sparked that addiction to kerosene, if you like, that both I and my brother have, actually. From that very early age.
And you were quite young, you were only 11, and your dad died.
Yeah, he died. I was 11, John was 9. He'd had lung cancer. And he was a sort of a man of his day. I think he smoked at the time 60 or 70 cigarettes a day, which is unimaginable. And he got lung cancer in 1977, and he had a lung and a half removed. And you can actually survive on half a lung. But unfortunately, he couldn't kick the habit of smoking the cigarettes. And about 8 months after he'd had that major operation, he died at 3 o'clock in the morning, August 1978, which was traumatic, to say the least. And I was 11, yeah.
Devastating. And it's funny how quickly you roll off the time of night or morning it was and the month. And
yeah,
it's still very much present there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's 45 years ago, and I can remember it the precise moment. I can remember exactly what happened. And I remember my mother saying to me, he was in her arms, right? And she was distraught. And she was saying, Donald, ring 999. And I remember going down to the old rotary phones, right? And ringing 999. And for years later, I would have this recurring dream / nightmare of doing that, but unable to actually dial the numbers. And, you know, that's unfortunately was a recurring dream for years and years and years. So, yeah, it was a traumatic and traumatic moment. An early parental loss, like death. You know, there are people who suffer, you know, post-traumatic issues as a consequence of that for a very long time. And I think I certainly did. And my
brother. In what way?
I would say, and I've only got to deal with it in my own mind in the last 10 years, to be honest. You know, I think I kind of had to give up my childhood in terms of, I was 11. And I just had to sort of, there's only two of us, my brother and I and my mother. And so I just had to step in to be the quote unquote, the man of the house and play that role. And
that was a huge role at 11 to even think for you that that was your role and the sense of responsibility and burden of that.
Yeah. You know, I don't even know if I thought it was my role. It's just that was the right thing to do, if you like. And my poor mother had come from a farming background in Galway, and she wasn't a businesswoman per se. And so I sort of had to mind the shillings. And there wasn't many shillings at the time. So we were out working, you know, Saturday jobs, summer jobs from the age of 12 or 13.
Did you feel, was there a part of you that felt frustrated or angry that you'd lost him at such an early age and the circumstances in which it had happened?
Yeah, I know. I haven't really ever spoken about how I felt about that, but the reality is that I didn't forgive him for several decades for dying. I thought it was a very, you know, selfish act, if you like. And the selfish part of it was that he couldn't kick the fags, couldn't kick the cigarettes. And that ultimately led to a massive heart attack in the middle of the night. And through counselling, actually, you know, about 10 years ago, I began the process of just letting that go and that he didn't do it on purpose, of course. And, you know, it was just that was the way the cards were dealt. And I let that go, that burden go. And I think I've been a better human being as a consequence of that.
But it's extraordinary that you would have carried that around for such a long time.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are people listening to this who've had exactly the same experience as me, you know, that early parental loss and the adversity that travels with it. And the other side of it, of course, though, it's not all negative. The other side of it is that, you know, you become a very strong person because you have to be. And whether it's sort of tenacity or whatever it happens to be, or adaptability. But, you know, in the round, you'd prefer not to have to go through that experience. And I remember, you know, going back to school into fifth class, because he died at the end of August and school would have started a week or two later, ashamed. Like, I was the only kid in the class who didn't have a dad. And I remember feeling very ashamed and embarrassed by that fact for a very long time.
Very difficult for your mom. And how then, you know, did her influence what she brought to bear in terms of shaping you and your brother as teenagers and as men?
Yeah, well, she became the North Star. And, you know, and she died of lung cancer, but from passive smoking 20 years later. But my relationship with my mother and John's relationship was very deep. We became very tight. And she was an extraordinary woman and, you know, loved in Ennis, loved to play her cards, went dancing. She never had another partner after that. I mean, we became her entire focus. And it was a joy. It was a joyous family triumvirate, if you like, in that scenario. So she was, you know, just a very powerful woman, amazing.
So finding yourself in that situation and carrying a sense of responsibility, a sort of a growing up very quickly because of the change in circumstances that you had, you obviously developed that work ethic. Did you have a lot of drive? Did you know what you wanted to do career-wise?
Well, I might have mentioned this to you years ago, Richard, but from about the age of 15, I used to work as a radio DJ in a pirate radio station in Ennis. So my absolute passion then and today is actually radio. And so I wanted to be a radio presenter. And then I kind of realised, you don't make an awful lot of money on that, especially in pirate radio.
Tell me about it.
And when I went to college...
Not as much as aviation leasing, but a bit of a difference there.
But I went to UCG and I worked on the radio station in Galway, and I did my thesis, my business thesis in commerce, on the establishment of a radio station in 1987. So that was my thing. And I was deeply passionate about it, and I was a total radio nerd. You know, I'd listen to Luxembourg, Radio Luxembourg and Howard Stern. We'd bring in the radio cassettes from America just to listen to how we would, you know, deal with and manage and produce his program. So that was my passion. But the opportunity to go work with Tony Ryan at GPA, it wasn't an opportunity. I just blagged my way in. But I wanted to do it because down in Shannon, you had GPA, which was this amazing place. And everybody that worked in there was a gazillionaire, and they traveled around the world doing deals. And I said, that's for me. I just think that's the way I want to
go. So when you say you blagged your way in, what was the interview like? Or?
Well, it was a series of interviews. And the conclusion was, no, you're too young. You don't have a first class honours degree. You have no experience. So no. And then I just kept at them and I said, I'll do anything to get in, literally. So a guy called Phil Bulger, who ran the trading floor at GPA at the time. So this is 1989, I was 22. He gave me a job working in what was effectively the mailroom. So collecting faxes, photocopying faxes. And that was the start of it. And, within a week, I just knew this was the industry I was destined to be in, and, you know, just loved it.
And you learned very quickly, but also Tony Ryan, the way he ran things, if a person who showed a lot of ability or a lot of talent, it didn't matter the fact that you were in your early or mid-20s. Mm. You got promoted and you were given a lot of responsibility very quickly.
Yeah, so Tony had an innate ability to pick talent, right? And it was one of the great skills that he had as a business leader. And he was insensitive to your age. So, you know, good enough, you're old. If you're good enough, you're old enough. And my first real opportunity came out of Pan Am Airlines defaulting and going bankrupt. And we had a bunch of aircraft that were due to go to Pan Am on lease that needed to be placed literally anywhere in the world. So I got the tap on the shoulder and said, you know, do you speak Spanish? And I said, no. Do you speak Portuguese? No. Well, you're going to South America and don't come back until, you know, you've placed, you know, X number of airplanes. And I literally got on an airplane and flew to Sao Paulo, Brazil. And that was the beginning of the journey.
And at one stage, you were practically commuting to Brazil.
Yeah. So Tony had this... must have an objective that everybody had to be back in Shannon for the famous Monday morning meeting. So there was no email at the time, there's no Zoom, okay? And many people, not just me, commuted from wherever they were around the world. So on a Monday night, I would fly from Shannon to London, London to Sao Paulo, get into Sao Paulo on Tuesday morning, do your business there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then fly back Thursday night. And I did that every week for several years.
We won't talk about carbon footprints yet. We will get to that in a little while. But it was at a time when people weren't thinking about carbon footprints, really.
No, not at the time. But we think about it very dearly now. I know we'll talk about it later.
How many flights would you have taken within a sort of, 12-month period?
I think at that stage, we're probably doing about 500,000 miles a year, which is a lot of flying.
What was... it like working in that organization, that company in GPA? For those who are not familiar with it, it was this rapidly growing, hugely successful aviation leasing business right at the forefront of what was going on in the world, led by Tony Ryan. And the plan was to float it on the stock market.
Yeah, the plan was to float it on the stock market 30 years ago, 1992. Like, it's unbelievable to think that's 30 years ago. So it was planned to go public in June 1992. Tony wanted to list the company in Tokyo, London, Dublin, New York simultaneously. It was going to be a $1 billion IPO, which was unheard of in any sector, in any country in the world. And he was hugely ambitious for the IPO. The IPO failed miserably for a bunch of reasons and would take us hours to go through it. And then GPA went into a debt spiral as a consequence of that. And then about a year and a half later, GE Capital acquired the business effectively.
Did you lose money on that IPO, that failed IPO?
I most certainly did. So that was one of my big lessons in life, that greed is not good. So I had borrowed, aged 24, 4.5, £1 million, Irish pounds, from two Irish banks. from the local branches in Shannon Airport, which were giving out money as loans to GPA staff to buy shares because it was a sure thing. Everybody was in on it. And so £1 million. I mean, I think you could have bought 20 houses in Dublin for £1 million then, right? And I lost every single penny of that. By the time the IPO failed, the shares went from being worth about $20 to being worth effectively zero.
So did the banks come after you? How did you navigate that or negotiate it with them?
Yeah, so I negotiated it to basically a repayment plan over 7 years. And that's actually was one of the catalysts for going to set up my own company, because I figured I needed to make more money. So that was a real massive life lesson. Age 25, ultimately.
And Donal, you set up then International Aviation Management Group, which, again, was very, very successful and was eventually bought out by RBS, wasn't it, Royal Bank of Scotland?
Yeah, so we set it up in 94, and the idea was pretty simple. We're going to go to the other side of the negotiating table, advise airlines on how to deal with aircraft leasing companies, banks, etc., etc. So we were an advisory company. We'd no balance sheet. But that grew over a 7 year period. And so we had all this knowledge and IP, but no balance sheet. And I met with RBS and they said, well, we'd like to buy you guys because we've got the balance sheet, but no knowledge. You've all the knowledge, no balance sheet. And so I sold the company in May of 2001, which is kind of an important time stamp, if you like, because 9/11 occurred several months later. And that was the beginning of what became RBS Aviation Capital, which is now SMBC, owned by Sumitomo Bank, which is the number two aircraft leasing company in the world.
And having done that, and I presume you made enough money to pay back the GPA £1 million and pay back the banks at that point. So that was something, and I'm sure you made a lot more as well. But you decided to go again with Avalon and set up a whole other aviation leasing company.
Yeah, so there's a piece in the middle, though, which I think is important. Again, just to share sort of adversity, if you like. So after I'd sold the RBS business, I worked there for a couple of years and then said, I'm done. And I decided I was going to set up an investment advisory company called Clara Capital, which is like a family office. And that was going gangbusters until 2008 when the crisis hit and it literally went wallop. And I lost every single penny that I'd ever made, plus, because I'd borrowed a lot of money to invest in deals. Not real estate stuff that most other guys were doing, but private equity. And it all went to zero, minus zero. So by 2009, I was literally borrowing from my brother to pay the interest on my mortgage. That's how bad it was for me not so long ago. And so Avalon was out of absolute necessity to survive and then, you know, get back on the feet and, you know, hope and hopefully succeed. And that's what it became. And it became the greatest gift from God ever, Avalon, with my founders, co-founders. There was six or seven of us came together to actually, it wasn't me on my own, you know, which I'd never, ever really been able to operate on my own. I've always had people around me. And we launched the company in 2010. And
it literally took off from there. You floated in the New York Stock Exchange, which was probably, given what you're describing about the financial adversity and all of that, a really big, important day for you.
Yeah, you and I have spoken about it before and you know, on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, floating your baby, if you like, at least your corporate baby, is the summit of many people's ambitions. It certainly was mine at the time. And it put to rest, actually, the ghost of GPA, because GPA had failed to do the IPO. And so I remember thinking on the floor, but God rest Tony Ryan, saying, we finally got here. And it was a wonderful day, yeah.
The company was then bought out a few years later by a group ultimately owned by the Chinese financial giant HNA. You would have done financially very well out of that. You stayed with Avalon, you stayed running the group. What was it like having a Chinese company as owners of the business?
Yeah, so they bought the company in January 2016. So actually, we were only public for less than a year and they paid a 55% premium to the IPO. So it was an excellent financial outcome for all the shareholders. And they asked me to move to Hong Kong. They were based in China, obviously, and they had big operations in Hong Kong. So they asked me to move to Hong Kong to help integrate Avalon into the H&A group. And I was actually excited about doing that because I was very ambitious in terms of understanding the difference between the Eastern and Western culture. And I could see, I'd read a lot about China at that point, And, you know, the fact of China's role in the world, I mean, it was the largest economy in the world for 18 of the last 20 centuries. And so China, in my mind, was only regaining its rightful place in the world as a premier global power. And I wanted to see what that was really like. And over the course of the year and a bit that I was there, I really got to see that culture. And did I say I truly understand it? No, you'd need to be there for decades. But it was an interesting time. And there are fundamental differences with the way they think about the world and the way the West thinks about the world.
What does that look like when you're inside a company that's Chinese owned and ultimately Chinese run, the parent group?
Chaotic at times. Boundaryless ambition. No restraints in their expectations. So they'd come from, you know, the guys who were leading this business were entrepreneurs, but they'd come from a communist background in terms of, you know, their upbringing. And so they saw the world as their sandbox to play in, to invest in. And there was no restraints, if you like. And there's a lot of good things about that. And then ultimately, if you take too much risk, bad things happen. And
well, it's no different to an American corporation in that sense, is it?
Yeah, probably no different, except one thing you'll see in America is better risk management, right? So they've been at it longer and they understand the downsides. And, you know, if you study the markets over a 50-year period, you know, they get pretty rough every couple of years. So the Americans had a better history of risk management and the Chinese were beginning to learn it.
When you look at geopolitical stuff that's going on now, growing tensions between the West and China, having, you know, had a sense of corporate Chinese world and having lived over there for a while. What do you make of what's going on now? Is it all going in the wrong direction?
Well, I would say the geopolitical, if you were to put a score on it, is probably the highest score being a high score is bad. It's probably the highest score it's been since the Second World War in my mind, or say the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's the hard reality of it. And what's happening now, which is unique, is that China is effectively flexing its economic and political muscle. And it didn't have the balance, the sovereign balance sheet to do that ever in the last 100 years. It does now. And the United States is really wrestling with trying to figure that out, how they, you know, work with the Chinese in a constructive, collaborative way. And the trust factor is zero, I would say. So it's a challenging time.
We mentioned about the aviation world, carbon footprints. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of the day, you know, aviation is a huge contributor to CO2 emissions. There are solutions being worked on, but ultimately, do we all have to re-examine how much we're flying, how often we're flying? What's your take on it?
Well, I don't think people will stop flying because of carbon emissions. So I think people will continue to fly. And there's a billion people in the world moving up into the middle class that have never stepped on an airplane that will start flying over the next number of years. So any sort of, idea that people will reduce flying is not going to happen. So what we have to do is make sure that the flying is more carbon efficient. And so there's a bunch of work going on that. So whether it's hydrogen aircraft, whether it's sustainable aviation fuels, or just different types of flying. So you saw France have banned all domestic flying. If there's a train alternative, that makes sense. Now, you know, aviation's part of the emissions program is about 2% globally. I mean, shipping is about 10 times that. So there's a lot of other sectors that are infinitely more carbon emitting than aviation. But nevertheless, we have a responsibility on our shoulders, those of us in the sector, okay, to be as clean as possible.
After Avalon, one of the things that you're behind and that's really occupying time and energy for you is this Innovate for Ireland program and idea you have. And it's about providing very high-end scholarships for very talented people from all around the world to come and do research in Ireland.
Yeah, so Chuck Feeney, you remember Chuck?
Yep.
So Chuck donated hundreds of millions of dollars to Irish universities, backed by the Irish government. Micheál Martin actually was the Minister for Education at the time. So my idea was we've now got the best infrastructure in the world in terms of the physical embodiment of our universities. So now let's fill that, supplement that, if you like, with some of the best brains in the world. And some research that I did a few years back called Project I said that the more PhD research you've got going through a country's university system, the more innovation will flow, more entrepreneurship, more societal value. So we've established Innovate for Ireland. It's a partnership with the government. It's a 300 million euro program. And starting next year, we're going to, in fact, we just announced our CEO yesterday, Simon Boucher, who was the former CEO of the IMI. So he's leading the charge. And we're busily fundraising. We've got about 60 million euros raised so far. And we're going to fund 1,200 scholarships. And we're going to bring the absolute best and brightest minds to the country.
How will you find them?
So our partner in this program is Science Foundation Ireland. So we're collaborating with the people who know their stuff. And so we'll do a global outreach. Literally, here's the scope and scale of what we're doing. And my vision as part of this is that we position the country to be energy independent. So I want my desire is the first cohort of PhD scholars are coming in here to figure out how we can install floating offshore wind and all of the infrastructure that goes with that.
Is it all about science and technology or other things as well? Are the scholarships broader than that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm obsessed about our storytelling. Being a nation of storytellers. So we're dedicating at least 25% of the scholarships to the arts, humanities and social sciences. And part of my idea is that if one PhD candidate is doing a piece in nanotechnology, so really nerdy stuff, if you like, amazing but nerdy, and somebody's doing a PhD in Greek architecture, we'll oblige them to work together on projects during their PhD, left brain, right brain. And when that happens, amazing things can occur.
So where do you think they'll be based? All around the country?
Yeah,
plugged into universities?
Yes. So it's an all-island initiative. It's the first all-island initiative in education. There is nothing like it in the world in terms of the size and the scale of this ambition. So this is going to move the needle for the sovereign, for the country. And it will have multi-decades impact. And, you know, hats off to the government for supporting us in this endeavour and stepping up and being a partner, dollar for dollar, euro for euro.
And finally, Donald, one other. You're an advisor to a company called Spin Launch, which is about launching satellites in a different way.
Yeah, so back to the carbon reduction piece. So when satellites are put into space, they're obviously put in space by rockets. And rockets are pretty dirty in terms of emissions. So Spin Launch have figured out a way, without overcomplicating this, to get satellites into space by spinning them. So if you think like a catapult or a salad dryer, okay? And basically this thing revolves in a big spinner with a satellite at the end to 5,000 revs per minute. And when it comes out the chute, like a catapult, it's going at 5,000 miles per hour.
Without the rocket fuel?
Without the rocket fuel. I mean, 95% of a rocket is fuel. There's only 5% payload. So this is at the leading edge of technological boundaries, right? We're trying to figure this out. But it's an American company. It's hugely exciting.
Sounds absolutely fascinating. Donald Slattery, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.